Good morning, everyone. Good morning. I hope that you're having a great morning, having your coffee, your tea, some breakfast. The traffic was tough this morning, coming from all corners around the island and in the island, but the morning was wonderful. I hope you had a beautiful view today as well, besides the commute. My name is Hugo Melgar Quiñones. I am the director of the McGill Institute for Global Food Security. And I welcome you back to the 8th McGill Conference on Global Food Security. It's a pleasure for me to welcome you here this morning. Yesterday we had a very interesting, stimulating session with our public lecturer, the president of IFAD, Dr. Nwanze. I would like to share with you also very briefly that last afternoon we worked with several colleagues in this room, faculty at McGill, several graduate students, colleagues from different development agencies, especially our colleagues from CARE, in a workshop where we launched a collaboration that is starting right now. Basically, our workshop focused basically on the importance of the intersectorial partnerships to advance the agenda towards food security and a world free from hunger. I am very pleased to inform you, share with you, that McGill and CARE are launching this partnership on the foundation of a $40 million grant that was submitted some months ago to the Department of Foreign Affairs, Trade and Development in Ottawa. And these grants have been approved for funding. We are very, very excited about this. We are looking forward to strengthening this collaboration with our colleagues at CARE. We're going to be working in Ethiopia, in Malawi, in Mozambique, and in Zambia. Thank you so much to my CARE colleagues for inviting us to be part of these projects, of these proposals, and to welcome us in this partnership. So I start with very good news for all of us this day. To start with our program this morning, allow me to introduce Dean Anya Guidman, who is the Dean of the Faculty of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences in the McDonald campus. Dean Guidman joined our faculty September 1st, so he's about to complete 2 months in this job, and we are very, very happy to have you here, welcome you in this conference. Welcome to this effort, collective effort, by many of our colleagues, students, and so on. Professor Guidman, as I mentioned, is a professor and dean in our faculty. From 2001 and to 2015, she was a professor at the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of Montreal and a scientist at the Institute of Research in Plant Biology. She obtained her PhD in 1997 from the University of Siena in Italy, following undergraduate and graduate studies at the University of Constance in Germany. At Oregon State University in the United States and the Stockholm University in Sweden. Between 1997 and 2001, she performed postdoctoral research at the University of Laval in Quebec and at the University of Wageningen in the Netherlands. She currently serves as president of the Canadian Society of Plant Biologists and as past president of the Microscopical Society of Canada. Dr. Guidman leads an interdisciplinary team of cell biologists and mechanical engineers, and her research program focuses on the biomechanical principles governing plant development and reproduction. Please join me in welcoming Professor Guidman. Bigay ng...
Bonjour, good morning. Je suis enchantée d'être ici. I'm really happy to see you all bright and bushy-tailed early in the morning. So am I, hopefully. As Hugo just mentioned, I'm actually a person looking at cell mechanics. I look at individual plant cells develop in particular shapes. What brought me here? I'm going to tell you that. I started in September as the dean of the faculty, but before that, I was a professor at the University of Montreal. So this summer, I went to a couple of scientific meetings in plant cell biology, and I told my colleagues, my scientist colleagues, that I was about to embark on a career as a dean, and they were like, "For crying out loud, why are you going to the dark side? Administration is considered at university as the dark side. And why would you want to jeopardize your own research program?" And then I said, you know, I'm having fun looking at growing pollen tubes, for example, and it's great basic research. I've done this for many years, but at some point you want to do something that has more impact. So I figured, what could have more impact than trying to serve and trying to support the people who do research that has real impact on the world and society? And so this is you. This is all of you. I'm here to hopefully help you to work and to perform as best as you can. This conference is really a celebration of your collective efforts to try to improve the world situation and to eradicate hunger. It is in particular a fantastic initiative that combines different disciplines. It includes people working in animal science and plant science, but also engineering efforts, so it's very interdisciplinary. But also, it brings together academics and institutions. And that is very important, because we can all work in our own little corner and try to find solutions, but it is the synergy between different people who then try to connect dots that makes an impact. The most amazing thing about this meeting here, though, is actually you. I see the average age here is very low, and that tells me that most of you are students. And so it is fantastic to see that the next generation is not only enthusiastic about this topic, about food security, but you're willing to put in your career efforts, your graduate studies, your future efforts into this. And I'm amazed about you doing this and wanting to contribute in this sense to your own education, but also to the benefit of society worldwide. So with that, I'm enthusiastic to open this conference, and I wish you a very, very fruitful day today.
Thank you so much, Dean Guidman, for your words of encouragement. It is my pleasure now to introduce Professor Chandra Madramutu, who will then introduce our keynote speaker of this morning. Professor Madramutu is a James McGill Professor in the Department of Bioresource Engineering. He was a dean of the Faculty of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences from 2005 to 2015. Prior to that, he was the director of the Bray Center for Water Resources Management. In an academic career of over 30 years at McGill, he has supervised over 80 graduate students and authored or co-authored over 200 refereed journal papers. Professor Madramutu has a very lengthy curriculum in contributing to the cause for food security and the fight against hunger, among others, the foundation of this conference. Once again, I want to thank you for your support to this conference, for being instrumental in bringing us top speakers to share with our audience their experiences and knowledge. Professor Madramutu, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Hugo, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning, Dean Guidman, and my colleagues and our students and friends who work with us in the global fight against hunger and malnutrition. It's indeed a really great pleasure for me to introduce to you this morning someone whom I consider not just a superb colleague, but also an equally great friend and a confidant in our work together in this fight against global hunger, malnutrition, and also the eradication of poverty. David Bergvinson is a fellow Canadian with us, a native of Vancouver, British Columbia. David studied at Simon Fraser, where he did his undergraduate work, and then at the University of Ottawa, where he did his PhD in plant breeding and plant biochemistry. And following that, embarked on a highly productive and successful career with the CGIAR, where he worked with one of our sister centers in the CG, CIMMYT, the International Center for the Improvement of Wheat and Maize. Worked for 14 years with CIMMYT in their pest and disease entomology program and in their crop genetics, crop breeding programs, and made a tremendous impact on crop variety improvement, particularly in maize, in just about every part of the world, developing world, in Africa and Asia. He was lured away from CIMMYT to work with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, where he led several initiatives in the foundation on crop improvement and also at the breeding programs for a variety of crops, more than just rice, wheat, and maize, several of the crops that we work with in legumes and cereals around the world. David has had a remarkable career, led many new initiatives and funding programs with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. But more recently, he served as Bill Gates' personal advisor on digital agriculture. And it is from that position that I was able to lure David away, or poach him away from under the clutches and arms of Bill Gates. So, David, we consider that a feat to have moved you from under the arms of Bill Gates to get you to be the Director General of ICRISAT. And when the board chairs of the CG Centers, my 14 colleagues and I, meet twice a year, we share notes, as we will be meeting over the next couple of days in Washington, D.C. We share notes with each other on what have been the most difficult decisions board chairs have had to make in their respective centers, and also what have been some of the best decisions we've had to make. And I've always said to my fellow board chairs, for me, the most difficult decision, but the best decision I've made as a board chair, is to recruit David Bergvinson to be the Director General of ICRISAT. David, we share a common passion for improvement of smallholder agriculture and bringing the people of the dryland tropics out of poverty, hunger, and malnutrition. And David brings a tremendous skill set in value chains and the use of digital technologies across the spectrum, from the basic breeding, genetics, and genomics programs right through to markets and nutrition, improvement of human nutrition. David, it's a really great pleasure to work with you and to have you here. Welcome to McGill.
Great.
The floor is yours. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Chandra, for those kind words, and good morning, everyone. I like to get to know my audiences before I get into a talk, so I'm going to indulge and ask you a few questions, nothing terribly personal. For example, how many of you have a watch? You know, one of these? Just raise your hand. Okay, so it looks like about 15%, 20%. How many have one of these? A smartphone? I think we're pretty close to 90%. There's some shy ones over there. So of those that do have a smartphone, do you use it for social media? Raise your hand. So basically everyone has a phone. Some of the older ones don't use social media, but myself included. What about for buying items? Do you buy anything on your cell phone, through your cell phone? fewer group. And how many of you sell things using your cell phone? Even fewer still. I suspect that over the next decade that all of you will be raising your hands to the last four questions that I asked. And this is the most ubiquitous technology that's ever penetrated the planet. There's more cell phones on the planet than there are people now. And what that opens up for us as far as achieving the sustainable development goals is hopefully something I'm going to touch on in the course of this presentation and really welcome your questions at the end of it. I don't know how many of you know about the sustainable development goals. If you raise your hand, if you do, that's a good sign. So these are ambitious goals that we're setting ourselves accountable for the next 15 years. It's a huge mandate. It's going to take all of us to do it. But it's also going to take innovation and the smart application of technology to achieve these goals over the next 15 years. I'm hopeful. I have a sense of urgency, like Kanayo spoke last night. Dr. Nwanzi called on us to action. And I hope all of us are biased to action because that's what it's going to take for us to reach these sustainable development goals before 2030. Professor Chandra Madramutu and I were talking this morning about seeing firsthand in the eyes of a poor person what it's like to live in abject poverty and to eke out an existence for themselves and their families. Nothing is more transformational in your life than seeing that. I hope all of you have an opportunity to experience that. So over the last, since 1990, we've had these Millennium Development Goals, and we did reasonably well in achieving them. We halved extreme poverty and halved extreme hunger. But that wasn't enough, as Dr. Nwanzi mentioned last night. If we have just one child out there, we still have a job to do. And so we have a big task ahead of us. But you'll notice agriculture is not mentioned in any one of these eight goals that we had set for ourselves. We've replaced these now on September 25th this year with 17 sustainable development goals. They're more focused than the eight, and they're broader in their collective scope. But when you look at them, most of them touch on agriculture in some way. As Dr. Nwanzi mentioned, 75% of the poverty resides in rural communities around the globe, especially in developing countries. Agriculture is the engine that's going to drive the growth and lift people out of poverty. So that'll address both hunger and poverty together. But we're not going to do that without education. And I would submit that this device here is going to be a very powerful tool for educating the masses around nutrition, health, and equity, which touches on the fifth goal, gender equity. There's a differential between men and women farmers of around 25%. And a lot of that is attributed to the lack of inputs, lack of access to knowledge, and to markets. I'm a believer that if designed well, innovation, especially around mobile technology, can be an equalizer. Clean water. Water is a major ingredient for our food. 70% of fresh water is used for agriculture production. And so we have to be smarter about the use of water. And again, the application of expert systems to better manage water resources and to use them efficiently in food production is going to be key. I mentioned growth in rural sector around jobs and agriculture playing an important role. But I think the one that is particularly important for this audience is around consumer awareness. Because all of the decisions you make in the shopping, in the supermarket, impacts on what farmers grow in the long term. And I think these decisions are very important as we look at diets and sustainable diets within a modern food system. But we also need to protect the planet. And so as we look at climate change, agriculture is a major contributor to climate change, but it's also a major solution if managed well, especially in the form of carbon capture in the soil to improve the health of soils and their productivity. And partnerships. We're not going to be doing this alone. As the dean just mentioned, it's going to take everyone bringing their unique skill sets, perspectives, and disciplines working in concert in order to achieve these big goals ahead of us. So it's probably good to define what digital agriculture is, given that's the title of the talk. This is not an official definition. It's the one I use. It's still evolving what digital agriculture is actually, and all of you can help shape that definition over time. I believe it's the application of ICT and data ecosystems, especially within the cloud, to support the development and delivery of timely, targeted information and services to make farming profitable and sustainable while delivering safe, nutritious, and affordable food for all. Now you can see why this is going to be such a big player in us achieving the Sustainable Development Goals. From a technical perspective, we'll be drawing on cloud computing, which is a very rapidly growing industry. Mobile technology, as I mentioned, there's more than 7 billion smartphones or cell phones out there, and a rapid migration to smartphones within that. Remote sensing technology. Satellite imaging and unmanned aerial vehicles are changing the landscape in which we can see the planet and make decisions from an informed perspective. Sensor technology, the Internet of Things, very powerful as well. Our use and application of data through bioinformatics and systems biology. This area is revolutionizing science. It started with physics, it's now moving to biological sciences, and it's going to help us grapple with the complexity of integrating different components of science towards delivering sustainable solutions. But all of this has to be framed within demand-driven innovation. You have to know your customer. You have to ask what your customer is looking for when you design science outputs. If you don't, you run the failure of investing a large portion of your career only to see those outputs not being adopted by society and improving society. So demand-driven innovation is really the order of the day, and engaging, in our case, smallholder farmers in defining what that looks like. There's three main areas where digital technology can contribute to society, and it touches on everyone. Doesn't matter if you're a smallholder farmer in Kenya or a student here in McGill. It's economics, it's managing risk, and trust. So for farmers, economics is really important. There's more than 500 million smallholder farmers around the planet. But unfortunately, because they have limited access to information and knowledge around the marketplace, they're unable to translate their production into economic opportunity. And so what happens is the aggregators that go up this food chain are really the ones that are capturing the value of the hard work of men and women farmers around the planet. And it's not to say that they shouldn't be capturing value and generating profits, because that's what a sustainable company does. But we want to use technology to push the value of that production to the extremes, pushing it to the farmer to capture a lot of the value at their farm gate, and pushing the value to the consumers in the form of safe, affordable, and nutritious food. I really believe that mobile offers a platform for farmers to jump up that value chain, that economic pyramid, to realize value through local storage. In our conversation last night with Dr. Nwanze, he mentioned if he could repeat his career over again, what would he do? He would go into storage, because he sees so many farmers lose value because they can't store their produce. So how do we use these technologies to help farmers store, manage their surplus production, and to capitalize on it in the form of the marketplace? But also to add value. A lot of the value add takes place in cities, and how can we use technology to push more of that value addition near the farms where the food is produced? And I think it's a tremendous opportunity, especially as we look at young entrepreneurs in Africa and Asia and creating economic opportunities for them. They don't need to necessarily farm. They could also be in the villages doing value addition, processing that raw material into a value-added food for urban consumers. The second big area for farmers is risk, and this is global. It doesn't matter if you're a farmer in Manitoba or you're a farmer in Malawi. Risk is very important, and it drives your decision-making. Again, Dr. Nwanze pointed this out, that it's very logical why farmers don't invest in Africa, because the risks are so high and they don't have insights and tools to manage against those risks. With climate change, we're seeing increased rainfall variability. That's a major risk, especially given that in Africa, 97% of the production of agriculture is rain-fed. In Asia, it's about 60%. Labor is another big risk. Labor is scarce, and when you need labor to harvest your crop and it's not available, that's a huge risk, because you can't translate that into the grain store. It just sits out there and rots. Knowledge, another big risk. especially when it comes to trading your commodity. Access to quality inputs. Seed is a very important ingredient in the farming system, and you have to trust the person you're buying the seed from that it is as advertised, that it's high quality, it's the right variety for your conditions in order to maximize your productivity. Access to credit is a big risk for farmers. Very limited access, and the access that they can have to credit often comes with very high interest rates. The post-harvest, the storage. Lack of access to storage is a major consideration all around the world, especially in places like India. Market information, again, a big problem for smallholder farmers, as is access to those markets. Price volatility. We saw the rice crisis of 2007 and 8, double the price of rice. You know who pays the biggest price when commodities like that double? It's the poor consumer, because they spend about 30 to 40% of their annual budget on food. You spend about 8 to 10% of your budget on food. So when those prices double, it kicks theirs up to 80%, it kicks yours up to 20%. It impacts you, but it's life-changing for them, and hard decisions have to be made, often meaning pulling kids out of school in order to feed them. And the risk, of course, of you know, the ecological system. We're living beyond the ecological boundaries of the planet right now, water or land resources. And so these also are big risks for us. The third area that's really important for smallholder farmers is trust. In the banking industry, they have a phrase called circles of trust. And the customer is most comfortable with institutions and people that are close to them, especially around issues of finance. And as you get further and further away into a regional bank or a national bank that's across the country, people lose trust. And in farming, it's very much the same. Farmers trust other farmers, especially within their family, the most. Then they trust people within their village, then neighboring villages, and then within their country. But they really don't trust people that are outside their country, and much less so people that are outside their continent. And so how do we use these technologies to build these bridges of trust so that international organizations like McGill can work with an organization like ICRISAT, come together and work with farmers producers organizations in Africa or South Asia to really deliver value? And it really comes back to building trust, and how do we use technology to do that? It's a complicated area, and I would say the science of delivery and how we unlock these technologies is a very fruitful area, and I would challenge the students here to be thinking about that as a career, because it's going to be much needed over the next decade. So what we have today is this whole ecosystem of data that's floating around in the cloud, hitting your cell phones, and we're bombarded with information. But what do we do? How do we distill that information to inform decisions? And for agriculture, we're really at a critical point right now where we're getting all of this data to support agriculture, but we don't know what to do with it all. And so decision support systems are going to be very important to help farmers distill what's relevant for them at the time for that location on their farm, to make an informed decision that increases their profitability, sustainability. And so this is really the area where digital technology or digital agriculture is going to come into play. Us being able to harvest this rich ecosystem of data, distilling it, translating it into knowledge, and delivering in a timely, targeted manner to empower farmers, whether they be a large farmer here in North America or a smallholder farmer in Africa or South Asia, to make the right decision for them. So I want to walk you through a narrative that will hopefully contextualize this story. So this lady here, her name is Amsala. She lives in Kenya. You can see that she has a hoe in one hand. She has a tray for carrying her harvest on her head. She has a baby with her. And she has her mobile phone. Now, this isn't too far from the truth. Smallholder farmers do have cell phones, despite the belief that they don't. They're very connected. And they value very much the power of the mobile phone. So what can Amsala do with her mobile phone? Well, that mobile phone is communicating information about her based on what she's who she's talking to, what she's buying. The government can use the mobile phone to deliver vouchers for fertilizer. Dr. Nwanze mentioned the example of Nigeria with e-wallet, where the government has changed their whole fertilizer scheme to deliver the benefits of fertilizer subsidies directly to farmers using the mobile phone. And the farmer can be registered to a farmer's organization that recognizes her as an individual with specific needs and priorities on her farm. Dr. Nwanze also mentioned the story of Ethiopia and the use of digital soil maps to guide decisions on what are the right micronutrients and macronutrients to improve soil health. As we look at the ecological footprint, an organization called Vital Signs is looking at how we're tracking the impact of agriculture on the landscape and making sure that we're responsible stewards of natural resources. And of course, for farmers, as I mentioned, Africa is largely rain-fed agriculture. And what drives that? It's the weather, it's the rainfall. And so that's a very valuable piece of information for farmers to make decisions about when to plant, what to plant, when to harvest. Now, Amsala is connected to other women farmers through farmers' organizations. And they're sharing knowledge using smartphones and tablets. One organization called Digital Green is using participatory video to help carry best practice from one farming community to another farming community, because when farmers speak to other farmers, that is the most trusted form of knowledge exchange. Satellites also are helping gather information and delivering that to farmers. And Amsala also belongs to a co-op that helps her market her surplus production and to buy inputs. Now, part of the system is the millers, and for a long time they've been separate from Amsala. But increasingly, they're getting connected to Amsala through the co-op and value addition of her raw material into value-added products, whether those be feed or food products. Now, an organization like ICRISAT comes into the picture when we start to understand what exactly are the types of grains needed to supply the feed industry, from a nutritional perspective, from an ecological perspective. And so we're using big data and bioinformatics to drive this genomic era of harnessing the rich diversity of genetic resources we have in gene banks and translating that into improved varieties that are climate smart, nutritious, and can empower farmers to be successful. And that's working with advanced research organizations like McGill or Cornell or the Beijing Genomics Institute in China. The world is getting smaller. As we use these digital technologies, the world is becoming ever connected. Not only are the problems connected, as Dr. Nwanze said, but the solutions are also very connected. Then we get into the last step, the bridging this last link, of actually empowering farmers to connect directly with warehouses to unlock the full value of their production. This has been the missing link, in which farmers have only captured a very small part of the economic opportunity. And with mobile phones now, they're able to integrate into the marketplace, both for the acquisition of inputs, but also for selling their surplus production into a fair and structured market that communicates in a very transparent way the grades and standards for farmers to maximize their profitability. And this is what's taking place now in the developing world. In some ways, the developing world, because of the necessity of poor infrastructure, they're very creative. They were Kenya was the first one to really implement mobile money through M-Pesa. Likewise, we're seeing these integrated value chains facilitated by mobile technology starting to emerge from Africa as the new business models for agriculture value chains. So at ICRISAT, what we're doing is working with partners within the national programs to use a value chain approach to diagnose across the value chain from basic research through production through to consumers. What are the key gaps that we need to address, that demand-driven innovation that we need to address, and who are the partners we need to bring on board to address those and to deliver them? So mobile phone is a vehicle for us to communicate and coordinate across that whole value chain, not the least of whom is smallholder farmers. And now with the new digital technology we have around cloud computing, we can put in place what we call the spatial data infrastructure to support that integration and coordination. And India is actually leading the way in how this can be done. They've implemented a global unique identifier program called Aadhaar. They've now registered more than 930 million residents of India on that platform. It's the way the government is going to make government-to-person payments for the bottom of the pyramid to empower them and support them in a very strategic and targeted way to make sure they have a quality life. But there's more to that. We have to have the enabling policy environment that includes how we manage this big data in a responsible way to protect the identity of individuals and to make sure that that data, the personal data, is used in a way that benefits the individual and that that data is managed in a responsible way, not to compromise people. Because I remember, that was the third parameter, trust. If we betray trust, the game's over. It's going to take a long time to regain that trust. So putting in place policies to make sure we preserve that trust and use this data responsibly. I mentioned bioinformatics. And all of this really is enabling us to support rapid cycle demand-driven innovation. Because what these technologies enable us to do is get feedback on what's working and what's not. And rather than waiting for a long, detailed assessment or evaluation 2 years or 3 years or even 5 years after a project, we can get that feedback within 2 days, 3 days, a month. And that really changes the game. That allows us to be much more agile in adjusting our programs to make sure that they achieve their goals. But also, it creates an ecosystem of integrated services. And this is what we're seeing happening in the developing world. It's not just about agriculture or finance or education or health. All of these things are coming together. Because rural families in Africa and Asia, they're asking questions about all of those areas every day of their lives. Do I have the finances to pay for the school fees? Is my child getting a quality education? Is that education influencing the nutrition decisions they make? It's great to see that McGill has integrated that into the system here. And how does that then drive the type of agriculture that we want to see around the world to make sure we achieve the Sustainable Development Goals? Producing safe, affordable, accessible food for all. So I think after this journey, you'll agree that digital technology is an important tool. It's not the panacea. It's not the only solution. But it's a vehicle that's going to support integration, collaboration, and ultimately achieving the Sustainable Development Goals before 2030. So I look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much, David, for, as usual, a great informative presentation. Hugo, how many minutes do we have for questions?
10 minutes
of questions. Great. I ask you please to use the microphones and to ask as many questions as you can get in the 10 minutes because David and I have to leave for Washington, D.C. Later today. So we have to leave the room. So please bombard him with questions. He's not unaccustomed to answering tough questions. Please, sir.
Hello, my name is Felix von Geyer. I'm a sustainable development journalist. That is actually really interesting. And I have found the way that agriculture, particularly in Africa, has bridged the digital divide quite actually revolutionary. So many things we could actually talk about on this. One is really the idea of urbanization, because for a decade, 15 years, everyone's been talking about urbanization as though it's some kind of inevitable process, and they haven't really been looking at the drivers of urbanization, which was addressed quite nicely last night. It's actually the relative poverty in the countryside. So I'm just wondering, with this breakthrough, obviously we've still got a long way to go, with digital architecture, do you feel that there's the possibility of actually taking pressure off the continuing urbanization trend and actually bringing more value back into the villages and the countryside through integrating industry?
So short answer is yes. Longer answer is, these technologies, I believe, are going to empower youth to be commercially viable in the agriculture sector. And it's going to bring sophistication and economics into the agricultural setting, which hasn't existed for the last, since time immemorial. So it is a real game changer. But we have to make sure that those youth are connected to markets, and urban markets are going to be the big driver. So consumers, as I mentioned, consumers are making decisions every day in the supermarket about what nutritious food you want, what you're willing to pay for it, and what quality assurance you have of its safety. These technologies, if used well, can give confidence to urban consumers and to know where they're buying their food from through traceability. Because of digital technology, you will have traceability. You will know where your milk came from, or where your eggs came from, or where your legumes came from. And so it is very interconnected. You're right, it has a long way to go. But we're starting to see flashes of what is possible. And this connecting farmers with urban consumers is very real. Actually, one organization called Sampark Foundation was looking at connecting urban women consumers with rural women farmers directly and empowering them in both. Empowering urban consumers to have nutritious food that they felt confident about, and of course empowering women farmers to increase their incomes. So it's definitely starting to happen. It will take time. If we put in place the right policies, incentives, and infrastructure, it's inevitable. This will happen because it's already starting.
Hugo?
Just briefly, Dave, in your opinion, which are the main challenges, the limits of this right now?
So right now, in many parts of Africa, for example, is connectivity. So we still don't have the infrastructure for access to cheap data for farmers to connect to this ecosystem of information. So that's one. The other is, of course, the social norms of women being able to access a smartphone. That's changing. But in some parts of the world, because of culture or religion, that's a constraint. I think the third is around this issue of trust. And that trust is earned. And so we have to give consumers confidence that the data and information is being used in a responsible manner. So I would say those are the three drivers that we need to be working towards solving.
Gianni, please.
Hi. Great presentation, by the way. I just wanted to elaborate a bit more on that second constraint you mentioned. You had mentioned about gender and technology, and my knowledge is not as extensive as other people in this room, but I was wondering if you could discuss a bit more the relationship between gender and technology, increasing adoption of that. I've heard that increasing technology makes men take more control and unempowers women, so I just wonder if you could comment on that.
Yeah, good point. So quite often when an industry is in its early stages and not very profitable, women will engage in it. As it becomes more profitable, men take over that. And again, this comes down to how do you design technology to make sure it's equitable and accessible for all. So in the case of Tanzania, women's organizations that couldn't afford a cell phone individually have actually come together and purchased a collective cell phone. And they have a collective bank account, and it has a six-digit password. And each of three members have two of the digits, and collectively, three of them can access the account. So that's a way of managing risk, building trust, gaining access to technology, and supporting a community approach to development. So where there are obstacles, there are creative ways around them, and I think that's where innovation comes into play. How do we use, you know, the innovation coming from universities, from the private sector, to make sure that all have access to these new technologies to empower them to realize their full potential.
Thank you. Please, sir.
Hello. If I'm not mistaken, I think that historically, technology has disproportionately benefited industry rather than small farmers. What makes you think that things are so different now? And that technology will go to benefit the smaller shareholders rather than industry again?
Yeah, great point. I think as we get to democratization of information and creating visibility around that, you'll see a shift. Already you're starting to see it in the United States where farmers are saying, hey, you've got my data. What else are you doing with it besides helping me determine my fertilizer application? And so this is creating an accountability framework for industry where they have to deliver value back to people, their customer, and to manage that data in a responsible way. What I'm advocating for is not just roles and permissions around data management. It's principles and certification so that companies are held to account, and it's part of their branding because their brand is very important. And they don't want to compromise that. So if you have a gold status as far as the way you manage your customers' data, that gives people confidence to come to you and to draw on your services. So it is an important question, but it's a complex one, but it's one we need to work on.
Please.
Hi, thank you for your presentation. I have read reports that cell phone banking has been found in developing countries to be not always very safe. So my question is, does that apply to other types of cell phone technology? Is that a problem that is inherent to cell phone technology, and can it be managed in developing countries?
Yeah, another great question. So indeed, it can be compromised. And so this is where we, as I just responded to the last question, use certification as an instrument to manage the risks. We need to also look at policies and technologies to safeguard the personal identification of users, of whether it be mobile banking or other services that are mobile enabled. You know, really when it comes down to it, technology is just an amplification of intent. If you have malintent, you can use technology to destroy things. I think what we want to do as a society is create a positive intent, and that's really rallying around these sustainable development goals and making sure that we use these technologies in a responsible, equitable way. So yes, smart people are going to do bad things, but I think most of us here don't want to see that happen. And because of the democratization of information and knowledge, we're going to make sure that it doesn't happen.
Thank you.
Please.
Hi. This is still on the topic of security of data, I guess. I was wondering is the data, the program's going to be monitored on a national level or an international level? And are corporations going to be responsible, or would it be government institutions?
So there's a variety of initiatives going on. One is the Global Open Data for Agriculture and Nutrition, GODAN. This was initiated in 2013. I think it has close to 200 organizations that have signed up for it, including the CGIAR, which ICRISAT is part of. And really, it's creating a framework for data to be shared in a responsible way to support development. And so that's one platform. Governments have open data policies, United States, Canada, India. And so there's those platforms as well. All of these need to be safeguarded against cyber attack and misuse of data. But again, I think we are aware of these and keep track of them. I know our systems are under attack, probably as McGill's computer system is under attack all the time. You know, putting in place appropriate safeguards. But again, it comes down to people using these technologies in a responsible way with good intent. You know, the precautionary principle would say, well, we shouldn't do this at all. It's just too unsafe. But, you know, so are cars. You know, cars are unsafe too, but we use them every day. And so, you know, it really comes down to what kind of future do we want to create by harnessing these technologies for good. I think that's the bottom line.
Thank you. Please, sir.
My name is Hector Galvez. I work at as a bioinformatician. And one of the challenges we constantly face is, as you mentioned, data overload. And we need to deal with ever-increasing data sets. But the problems we have is the talent, the IT capacity, is usually in fierce competition with other sectors, advertising, health sciences, and it's very difficult for bioinformatics to recruit top talent to tackle these problems. I'm just wondering, you, with your experience in the Bill Gates Foundation and with the background you have, what measures are being taken to recruit top talent to tackle these very important bioinformatics, systems biology, and in general, big data issues?
Well, I don't know if it's a good news or bad news, but all these sectors are converging. So the bioinformatics are eventually going to come to us. being a little facetious there. I think we actually need to educate a new generation of scientists that have an appreciation for how to do big data analytics and apply it to very practical problems. So it's not just the bioinformaticians working alone. It's actually a bioinformatician with a biochemistry background, with agronomy background, with a marketing background, to apply and these new tools in a very meaningful way for society. Not that bioinformaticians on their own aren't meaningful, but I think as we look at integration across different industries, disciplines, I think you're going to require a new skill set. And so I've been a strong promoter of massive open online courses, where we can educate the masses in a very targeted way, using analytics to tailor educational experiences to the needs of the individual. And so Nandan Nilekani, who was a previous CEO of Infosys in India, has set up his own foundation, and he's setting up a learning platform called XSTEP, E-K-S-T-E-P. And it's doing just that, using analytics to tailor the educational experience, in this case for elementary school students, because there's a large dropout rate there. But the same technology can be applied for training graduate students, for training extension officers, and potentially even farmers. So I think we have to unlock these technologies and scale up our skill set so that the skills that you have as a bioinformatician can be scaled up and have an impact not only in McGill, but around the planet.
We have two last questions.
Hello, my name is Antonio Spitro. I am a part of an urban agriculture community organization based here in Montreal. And my question was more specific about the cloud-based computing system, because we're suffering just now as we're trying to manage more than small gardens in the neighborhood. We're wondering if you have any thoughts or types where we can go to look for a collective management system based on cloud, like mobile applications that we can manage our farms and our volunteers and our, like, all our operation in one application, because we, and at least my personally believe, this is the future for small urban agricultural projects, but we're not getting anywhere. We don't have the capacity, and I was wondering if you have.
I don't want to commercially promote any one organization, but there are several options out there. And there's some open source options as well. So Open Data Kit is a mobile-based data collection platform that I actually helped a little bit with accelerated development of that platform to support organizations like yours, collect information, quickly visualize it, and then take decision. But there are many offerings out there. So, I think for you it's important to understand what are the requirements of your organization and actually list those down and then go through and look at the different options that are out there. It's probably the best way to do it. But there are several open source options available that I can share with you offline.
Last question, please.
Hello, I'm Amania Lasmar, and I'm a master's of student at Food Security Masters. My question is somehow far from data security. It's all about the trust circle. It was in the slide, and we were talking about that family. It is in the center of this trust circle, and we know that technology has so many advantages, but it was also responsible for the loss of familiar bonds in the urban areas, and it might be that technology introduction in these areas will be responsible for losing the family bond in these rural areas, and it will be the end that they will lose everything. They will lose their agriculture, and they will lose their family bond. So how this intervention will be really away from these kind of losses? Thank you.
Yeah, I think, the anthropology and social science around technology is very important and an area that needs a lot of work. You know, with any technology, There is change to society. Obviously, we don't want to lose social bonds. I mean, they're very important. I mean, it's really the resilience of a family that allows people to cope with shocks. So we certainly don't want to design technology that dissipates those relationships. I think in many cases it strengthens when people live far apart. I live quite a distance from my family, from my children. And I can go on to Skype or FaceTime or whatever and have a conversation and see them. That keeps the bond even when we're separated physically. So I think there's always these risks, and it's important to go into a new area of technology and making sure that we manage the downside of technology while optimizing its benefits for society. So point taken. I think it's a lot depends on the individual family and how they use technology responsibly.
Well, thank you very much, David, for your presentation and the Q&A period. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please join with me in thanking David Bergmanson once again. Thank you. Thank you.